My name is Carol Avery, and I'm sharing different experiences that I've had living in Saudi Arabia for the past 3 years, where my husband teaches English at a university, and I just this year started teaching sixth grade at an American school there, which has given me a kind of another sight of the country. And we enjoy it for the most part. There are frustrations, but then I guess there's frustrations in life in general. So today I wanted to center on what life is like for a Western woman in Saudi Arabia. And I wanted to talk about not only what it's like for me, but also what it's like for Western women who are married both to Saudis and to Arabs living in the country. And their life takes on a whole different role than mine does. She's not here. There was a lady who reminded me about it at noon because she said that her daughter has just been proposed to by a Saudi who's has a wife already in the country and is very, very wealthy and wants to lavish his wealth upon her, and apparently she's a bit tempted. So I want to deal with that topic because it's a touchy one, I think. But another thing that I want you to be thinking about that we can talk about towards the end of the hour is experiences that some of you have had in other countries, because I know a lot of, just in talking to people, a lot of you have lived in other countries and have experienced probably some of the same kind of things that I have. Or maybe things you've experienced with women living here from another country. How to deal with them and get along with them. So first of all, basically, just the basic differences it was for me moving there. I felt like I was well prepared and didn't suffer much of a culture shock. When I first moved there, it seems like as time goes on, things have been wearing on me more than they did at first. At first, I expected everything to be unusual and different. And the university was wonderful about sending us a lot of literature, exactly what to expect. And in some ways, I even expected a more conservative attitude than I found. I was under the impression that I'd need to be clothed completely all the time. Thus brought none of my own, you know, summer dresses and such, and then discovered on the university campus, women usually are dressed rather casually. So then I was stuck with virtually nothing to wear, and clothes are not easy to come by over there. They're easy to come by if you want to spend a lot of money, I should say. Or you can buy rather cheap clothes that are made in India and Pakistan, but which don't last long at all. But I kind of got by that first year. So dress was the first change. Yesterday I wore a typical Indian dress, long sleeves, that I would generally wear to go shopping in town. I always have a long dress or skirt on, usually long sleeve, though I cheat sometimes in the real hot weather and wear short sleeves. So that I've gotten used to. On campus, like I said, it's quite casual. And at the school I teach at, it's so Western. It's that alone is almost culture shock every day to go from the university to Dhahran Academy, it's called, where women are dressed, many of them very stylishly, because of course they're making their own money, a lot of jewelry, and it just seems very Western right at that school. The driving restrictions, I was aware of that women are not allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. And so it came as a pleasant surprise to me when I found out that we could drive on the university campus, at least as far as the store, the grocery store, and the recreation center, which for me is basically enough. And I love that little bit of freedom. We've been offered a house, a three-bedroom house for next year, but it's at a compound from which I can't drive. And it was that fact alone that made me decide I didn't want to move there. Because just that alone is nice. Some other differences that I mentioned again yesterday, how if I should ever choose to take public transportation, which I rarely do, the women are required to sit in the back of the bus, and there's a special section there where it's walled off from the rest of the bus so that none of the men can see us, nor can we see them. Because of that, we can't pay the fare to the bus driver, so there's just a little box in the back that you need to drop your fare in, so it's sort of an honor system that, you know, they don't know if we're going to pay or not, but there's nobody there to check up on us. And as I said, the most frustrating part is trying to see where it is you're supposed to get off, because you're walled in. You can only see out the side and the back windows. It's hard to tell where where your stop is, especially if it's a new place. But that's only for a novelty, really, that I've ever taken public transportation. It's a rather awkward procedure to get to the bus and wait for it. And our university provides transportation into town 3 times a week. Now that I'm working, I can't do that because the 2 mornings I'm working. But it's an old Bluebird school bus that runs into town and waits for 3 hours while you shop and then takes you back again. But the university has a taxi service too, which I use off and on, especially the last 2 weeks. My husband came back early with our daughters, so I was there for 2 weeks alone. And then I really felt the restriction because, of course, he has to take me everywhere. And without him there, several times we had to arrange for a taxi. I went with other women, both to a doctor appointment and into town. Something I wasn't really prepared for that I've kind of gotten used to is anytime we go to a restaurant to eat, there is a family section that you must sit in if you're a woman or if you're with your family. It's usually upstairs, curtained off. The general restaurant area is for men only. And I've made the mistake before of plopping myself down before I was used to when we were quite new there, just walking in and sitting and having everybody look at me like, what are you doing here? One time, a couple friends and myself, who took the public bus to a nearby city of Dammam. It's actually a larger city, and it's more Saudi. You don't see as many Westerners there. And we were parched and had a hard time finding a restaurant, and we finally did, and they looked at us like, what are you doing here? But decided they had service. They took us up a long flight of stairs to a huge dining area. It's completely dark up there. And there were tables stretched from wall to wall, and they turned on the lights, and there we sat in the middle of this huge room. And then they would come up the steps and get our order. Of course, they didn't have a menu or anything. It was a very confused procedure. Those little things have worn on me a little bit. Not that we even go out to eat that much, because I was saying yesterday how there's prayer time when things close down. In the evening, there's usually 2 fairly close together. So if you want to eat, you have to time it just right to get there between the 2 prayer times, or else wait till the later one, which gets too late if you have children. But I find that a little bit hard, having to be secluded and away from the main area in our little family section. You can't just go and sit and have a relaxed meal. One thing I forgot to mention yesterday in just everyday life, which many of you probably know, is that the 2 forbidden things in Saudi Arabia are pork and alcohol, and you can't find either of them anywhere. So you don't go to the restaurant and have a cocktail. You don't have a drink, which is sort of neither here nor there, but it's a restriction. The interesting thing is that many people make, especially wine, in their own homes, and that's fine if you do it in your own home, and you don't. It's only if you start to sell it that you could really get into trouble. But what's unusual is in the stores they sell case after case of very good fruit juice. It comes from Switzerland, I believe, somewhere in Europe, and it's made in bottles with one of these porcelain tops that flip open that you can reclose. In other words, it's made for bottling wine. You empty out your bottles, you make your wine, and you pour it all back in. And it's obvious that it's there for selling for that purpose. So it's, even though you're told not to have alcohol, and you're told not to make it, though it's, like I said, as long as it's within your own home, it's not a problem. It's obvious that that's what it's sold for, and people buy it by the cases. So interesting. Again, sorry to those of you who were here yesterday, but shopping in town and being covered once in a while, you can be stopped by a religious police if you're with your husband, and he may tell your husband to have his wife cover her head. And so I try to remember to carry a scarf along with me, though I generally don't. And then I need to just tie it around my head. If I didn't have one, then John would have to find, or we would have to go and find one. And that's never happened to me, but it's happened to quite a few of my Western friends. And the interesting thing is that I would never be approached myself by one of the religious police. It's only if my husband is there that they would tell him to get me covered up. So the people I've known who've been stopped have, it's bothered them a lot, and maybe it would me too. I don't take it that seriously. But the Saudis tend to be quite racist as regards Asian people too. And a good friend of mine who's Chinese extraction was stopped by the religious police for wearing too tight of clothing. Well, she was pregnant. She had a maternity smock top and rather baggy pants. It was a real ludicrous accusation, I thought. And her husband was furious about it. But generally, it's not too much of a problem. So, what do you do in a society where there's nothing to do? There are no real forms of entertainment. There's not such a thing as the theater. There's no fairs going on. There's the only thing to do is shop. There's no museums. There's no nothing really to do. So for the only entertainment is to shop, to go to the beach, which we do a lot of just about every weekend, and to visit other people. And I enjoy that. We have a wonderful community of people on campus that we do a lot of socializing with. But it gets old after a while. The nice part about living in the university campus is, first of all, there's a beautiful recreation center there where we can swim. There's a men's pool and a women's pool. And that I find to be a big advantage. And there are tennis courts and squash courts, which I don't participate in, but a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that your family can go swimming together, or you have to go separately?
Oh, no,
or
we must.
Tennis separately, too.
I think that the tennis, they do get by playing together. And they do have on Thursday morning, which is the equivalent of our Saturday morning, they do allow, though it's never publicized, family swim in the men's pool. And that's the one time that they allow us to swim together. But you can never call and ask when family swim is, because family swim isn't supposed to be. But it's one of those things, like driving on campus, the rules say this is not allowed, and yet they let you do it, and they kind of turn a blind eye. So we do get to swim together Thursday mornings if we want to.
Your husband couldn't take your daughters
into the pool. He could take them because they're little. Mm-hmm. When they get maybe 7, 8, it probably would be frowned upon. Usually the children go in the women's pool with them. So,
are there cultural events on the campus even?
Two things that go on campus. One is what has been a very active women's group. Now that so many expatriates are being let go, this past year especially, because of the oil crunch, the money supply is finally starting, we're starting to feel the pinch. A lot of people have been let go. And so we feel that as far as things like the women's group go. There just aren't as many people who are participating. It seems to be the Western women who get these things going. The Saudi women follow along with the activities, but that's a frustrating part, is they're not usually very active in doing the hard work. But the women's group arranges things like a Halloween party. They have arranged within a home a Christmas party where Santa Claus shows up, which of course is very hush-hush. But for the little kids, what other party? They have one in the spring, I think, at the beach, a family day party. So the women's group does quite a bit. And then we have a music appreciation club, which meets once a week, and that's wonderful. Again, as far as the university is concerned, that does not take place because it's a mixed gathering. Men and women are together, heaven forbid, and we can't publicize anything about the Music Appreciation Club. But we meet once a month and all display our musical talents, of which are not very many for a large part. But there will be a piano recital one night. An international night is really fun, where people come and do something musical from their own country. And that's kind of a highlight of the year for me. We had a group of Ghanaian people doing tribal dances in their costumes, and a French singer and a German group that sang, and just three Chinese gals who did a trio. And so we find those kind of gatherings to be so refreshing because they're very few and far between. The university does show a movie once a week for most of the year. They tend to be rather old movies and ones that are not real appealing, so we don't go that often. But once in a while they have a movie that's just shown on campus. And we usually try to take part in anything that goes on because it's not very often that we have something. Classes are offered too at the rec center through the women's group, usually exercise classes, weaving. There's one lady who's does beautiful weaving, and she has quite a collection, and she teaches it, and a pottery group where that's taught. So that's about the limit of what's available for us to do. When it comes to job opportunities for any women, about the only thing to do is what I'm doing, to teach at this American school or international school. And what's frustrating for me is that it's all or nothing. Either you don't do anything or you teach full time, whereas I would love to have a half-time job. It doesn't exist. So quite a few of us have jobs at the local international school. The school is basically run by couples hired from the U.S., a teaching team, and most of the teachers fall into that category, referred to as stateside hire. And then what they're lacking in the fall, they fill with people like me called local hire, who are there anyway because our husbands are there, and we happen to be teachers. The problem with that is there is a real discrepancy in pay between the stateside hire and the local hire. We have the basic salary scale, but the stateside hire gets an equivalent of one-third of their salary bonus every year as overseas deferential, it's called, besides which they get all their housing, transportation, health insurance, all those benefits, which we don't really need because we get them through our husband. But there's oftentimes a little bit of tension there. You know, why we're doing the exact same job, we're expected to do just as much as them, and yet they're getting a lot more than we are. So I felt that, especially as this year has gone on, the local hire seems to be snubbed a little bit.
When you describe this intense oppression of women, you don't sound very angry. Do you know why that is?
I guess because I just went there expecting it. You're right. In fact, sometimes my husband gets angry at me that I don't get more angry. So why? He thinks I defend the Arabs all the time. I don't know. I guess I just feel like, you know, they're living by their beliefs, and who am I to go in there and say, this isn't how it should be? And that's something I want to discuss more, is our ideas of women's rights, if that really is a universal idea, or if that's a Western concept that we have of how women should live. I'm not sure. But it's a good question, and I don't feel anger, although like I said, it's been wearing on me. By the end of this year, little things have been wearing on me a little bit. Why
is this? Going back to school, mm-hmm. The school that you're teaching on, mm-hmm. are female teachers or male?
I guess more female because of the local hire.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But in every other case, it's a teaching couple, so there was always a male and a female that are hired.
Are there single people that are also hired?
No, not at all. It's all couples from America or women who are there anyway. So that's one nice thing, is that you see a lot of male teachers. It's a nice balance that way. Another nice thing about the school is that, as far as I can see, discipline problems just don't really exist. My rationale, I was real confused as to why that would be for a while. My rationale is that, first of all, virtually every child comes from a two-parent family, because in order to go to Saudi Arabia, you're generally married. I mean, if you have a child, you're married and there with your children. A lot of parent concern. Almost all of our professional couples who are concerned about their children's education. We have fathers coming in all the time during the year, coming in to ask for a parent conference at the end of the school day. Something I didn't see at all really happening here. Maybe it happens more than was my experience. But and all of them are at least fairly wealthy. There's nobody who's a welfare case who, because everybody has at least a reasonable job. One of the hard things about the school is it's very expensive. Of course, it's a private school. Tuition now is nearly $5,000 a year per child. Most of us, I think 70% of us, our companies pay for our children to go to school. Our university does, but only after the children turn 6 years old. So when I started working in January, and we decided it'd be easiest for Jenny to go to kindergarten there, we had to pay for her to go to kindergarten. This is another thing that local hire do not get. We do not get education paid for our children, which a stateside hire would get. Another little tension. Usually we don't worry. Those of us who our company pays for the education, doesn't bother us too much how much it costs. But any Muslim child at all, child from a Muslim family, whether it's just the father or mother that is Muslim, the university will not pay for their education because they feel if they're Muslim, they can go to a Saudi school, and the Saudi schools are free. And many of them choose not to send their children to a Saudi school. Most of them do because the education is not very good, because a lot of these people, just because they're Muslim, doesn't mean they speak Arabic. There are the Turkish, big Turkish population there. Their children have never spoken Arabic. To plunk them in a Saudi school, you know, they just don't want that. So, time to turn my tape here. So, I feel real sorry for them. Some of them have 2-3 children, and they've chosen to send them to the school and are paying up to $15,000 a year to send their children to the school. And it's something.
Outside of the university?
Pardon?
Outside of
Oh, the vast majority are. Mm-hmm.
What are the people?
There are many, many private companies there. A lot of big technical industries are there, construction industries people are hired to work through. I should know that. Let's see, I know that there are about 600 in the intermediate school, which is grades 4 to 6. So there must be 1,500, 2,000. And it's grades K through 9. Once your children go beyond 9th grade, then it's a question of either leaving the country or sending them to boarding school. And a lot of people have their children in boarding school, different places, either in the U.S. or in Europe. So it's interesting. Anyway, that's about the only option for working for me. There are a few little jobs on campus that women are allowed to do, like working in the Recreation Center library. I believe it pays $2 an hour, and if you want to send your child to there's a little daycare at the Recreation Center. I think it's $2.50 an hour to send them there, so you're losing money to work at the library if you have children. But some women choose to do it anyway just because it's something to do, or if they don't have young children. It's ridiculous what they pay women to do anything on campus. They hire a very few to work doing proofreading at the research center on campus, and I think they have a few word processing positions. Again, it's never advertised. You have to just sort of find out about it, and the pay is nothing, really. So that's frustrating. Yes?
I was wondering about child care then.
Oh.
While you're teaching.
Okay. I'm sorry. I meant to bring that up. This is one big advantage of the job is that the Saudi government requires that free child care be provided on location for any working woman, and that's something that is kind of an advance in the Western idea, but their concern is for the family and for the children. So there's a wonderful daycare. In fact, it's located right next to my classroom where Kristen goes during the day. I'm free to visit her anytime during the day when I have free time. Next year, when I have a baby, they're required to give me time during the day to go to feed the baby. And so it's very much centered towards the family relationship. And that's probably the only reason I took the job, is because I saw what a good situation it was. She's very happy there. She just loves it. And so that's a huge benefit to the job. Free daycare, especially when I'm going to have two little ones, is quite a benefit that I would never find here.
How many Saudi women work outside the home?
Few, very few. tomorrow I'll be talking a little bit more about what their job opportunities are, and they're very few and far between. I don't know any Saudi women, except on campus there's an elementary school that's for Saudi children, or Muslim children, I should say, but generally Saudis are there. And there's a principal of the school who's a female Saudi. She's the only one I know of who works. A few are teachers, teach in a girls' school or a women's school, and there's not a whole lot left for them to do. So,
how long do you plan to stay there?
The big question is next year. I don't know. It'll be our fourth year next year, and my husband's contract will be up. Mm-hmm. And we just can't decide yet what to do. Half of me wishes they wouldn't offer us a contract, then we wouldn't have a decision to make. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that'll be the case. Mm-hmm. So it depends on what kind of job opportunities are awaiting us back here. Probably none, so we probably will end up staying some more. And now that I have my job, I'm really very happy being there. It was starting after 3 years, I was getting to be feeling rather closed in. Our houses are very much like caves. We have absolutely no windows in our house, except in the kitchen is just a little narrow one. And there's three patios off of our house, each of which has about an 8-foot wall up, so that, of course, nobody can see in on the women. And so you get a very closed-in feeling in these homes. And now that I'm working, I don't feel it so much. But when I was in the house much of the day, it would drive me crazy. I thought this would be the one time in my life that I could grow plants living in a country where there's so much sun. Our house is so dark, we have to have lights on all day. And still, I do not have a plant that lives more than 2 weeks. Maybe my fault, but...
Is the reason for the darkness that they can't see you?
Yes, so that no man can see the women. They try to keep... The Saudis themselves would live within a home that has a gate of huge stone wall all around the home. Again, this protectionism, keep the women from protected, keep them at home. Yes?
What's the crime rate on crimes against women, like rape and... domestic violence?
The crime rate in Saudi Arabia is almost nil. You never hear of a crime. The reason being that it's their method of justice is very swift and punishment. And supposedly, if a person steals, they get their hand cut off. I have never seen a one-handed Saudi, so I don't know that it happens that much. But crimes are dealt with very severely. And I've known several people who've been put in prison for selling homemade alcohol, and it's not been very pleasant for them. They haven't been tortured, but just dropped in there, have no way to communicate with anybody outside. So when people ask me, aren't you nervous living in the country? Aren't you scared of terrorism and such? I have to say, well, I am in a way, and yet when we lived in Portland, a gal was murdered two doors down from us in our apartment one night, and you know, I'd never imagined that anything like that would happen so close to home to me. And so the fact that you just don't worry about crime, you don't worry about your children ever being snatched or anything, is just something I probably get too used to it living there. It's not unusual to see people coming out of the bank with a wad of money like this, the men, and just tuck it in their thobe pocket and walk off, and you would never dream that anybody would try to take that. In fact, going into the bank is always a real a real interesting experience. And when money is taken, at least in one bank, the teller has a big table behind him, and as he takes the money, he just tosses it back on the table and is literally overflowing from the table. And then when you need change, he goes and picks out what he wants. You know, it would be the easiest place in the world for there to be a robbery, and there never is. The same in the gold markets, where the gold, at least in the more rural areas, is just sitting, you know, walls of it hanging right there where anybody could grab it, and nobody ever does. So it's nice that way. Yes?
You said last night that there are religious policemen.
Yes.
So do they have, like, civilian policemen?
Yes, they do have civilian policemen, too. I think members of the National Guard is what they are. Mm-hmm. And you do see them standing around with little submachine guns, I think they are. That makes me a little nervous. Also, the school where I teach at is on an American consulate grounds. The consulate is there, and the school is there. In the past 2 years, with the wave of terrorism, the security has become very tight there. The buses no longer can drive up to the school. They let us out at a gate outside of the school, and we walk up to the school. And there are guards sitting at the gate with guns. And the same to get into the consulate is they've built huge concrete walls, kind of, that you have to drive around to get in. And then you still have to get through a security gate. And there are men sitting there with guns. I'm afraid that's something you just get used to. I don't like to think that I have, because it really bothered me the first few times I went over there. But I guess it's a good thing.
But that's because you're American, right?
Because it's an American consulate, right. That the that's where the terrorism usually is taken out. Though terrorism doesn't seem to exist in Saudi Arabia, I'm sure that there are factions who wouldn't mind doing something like that. It's also interesting that an American woman cannot get a job at the consulate unless you're married to a government employee, like if my husband were in the military or such. But there are a lot of jobs at the consulate, and because I'm an American, I can't get it. And I've never figured out why, but maybe that's one of the reasons, is if there's an act of terrorism, they don't want the Americans to be involved. I'm not sure. But a lot of my British friends work there and have nice jobs, which I'd like. You know, I could have had maybe a half-time job working at the consulate, but not for Americans. Anyway, I want to answer more questions, but let me just go on a little bit what I said about a Western woman being married to a Saudi or to an Arab man. There's a book, which I guess I should have had the bookstore order. It's called At the Drop of the Veil. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's written by a lady by the name of Marianne Alireza, who was married to a Saudi, I think, in the 1940s. And was probably the first Western woman ever to live in the country. And it's an interesting book. It isn't extremely well written, and it's a bit dated, which is one reason I thought, well, maybe it wouldn't be the best one to have on hand, but now I kind of wish I did. So I recommend it to any of you. It gives a good insight of what it's like being married to a Saudi. She points out how she met him in Berkeley when he was going to school there, and they had many Saudi friends. They had a lot of parties at their house. You know, all these men would come over. And then the instant they got into the country, she was whisked off into the home with the women, and she could never see any of these men who she was good friends with. Now, all of a sudden, it was completely separate. That's one of the real frustrations, I think. I think that any American woman marrying an Arab, and a Saudi in particular, should really know what they're getting in for, because it's not an easy life. The Saudis are free to take on as many as 4 wives, and they'll do so at a whim. This is what happened to the lady in the book, is they had been married quite a few years. They had 5 children. I think they'd been married 12 years. And one day, she was told that he had just divorced her. She knew absolutely nothing about it. Then she was left with the children, but once the children turned 7 years old, the father has custody of those children. So she actually had to go through a daring adventure of kidnapping her own children and getting them back to the U.S. One of the problems with that was that her husband had all her passport and everything locked in a safe, so she couldn't even get a hold of that. Maybe that's a little extreme to what would happen today, but in many instances I think it would still be true. The few American women I know who are married to Saudis, they're not real open about how they feel. It's hard to tell. I don't think they want to always admit the rough parts. Like, I guess all of us have rough parts in our marriages, and we don't like to go to advertising it to people. One gal, the hardest part for her was when her daughter turned 14, her husband went to find a husband for her daughter. And it was the last thing she wanted, but she had no control over it at all. So he went and arranged a marriage, and it all happened, and there was nothing she could do about it.
And yes. Practice polygamy, though. I mean, they're only...
No, a man is allowed 4 wives at one time.
At one time.
A woman is not allowed more than one husband, but... Right. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, they are allowed to have four wives at one time. It doesn't happen very often anymore. I think largely because of the economics of housing more than one wife and all these children that are byproducts of it.
Do they have a great deal of children then?
Yes, many of them do. Although I think birth control is practiced quite a bit. It's sort of not much is said about it because I think basically they don't agree with it. But I know quite a few Saudis who only have two children who've been married for quite a few years, and obviously something's being done there. But there are also some that have very, very large families too. So another problem is, other than just getting used to living a more secluded life, for friends of mine who are married to Arabs other than Saudis, I think it's a little bit easier. My one good friend is married to an Algerian Muslim, and he's a wonderful fellow. He lived in the U.S. for quite a while. He's very open, very jovial. He was at our Christmas Music Appreciation Club gathering and wishing everybody a Merry Christmas and singing all the carols and everything. But this past month, being the month of Ramadan, where the Muslims have to fast from sunrise to sunset, of course he then wanted to eat his meals all night long. Well, they have a young baby, an infant, who still wanted to sleep all night, you know, and be up all day. And so Martha, my friend, was kind of caught in between, trying to take care of her husband, feed him in the middle of all hours of the night, when she knew she couldn't sleep all day because she had a little baby who would be up. And his mother-in-law was visiting as well. So the two of them were really practicing this fasting. And she said she'd get up in the morning and sneak in the kitchen and close the door and drink a cup of coffee and eat some cereal. She said she didn't want to do it in front of them. But she found that very difficult to try to deal with those customs when you're not a part of it. And I can see where that would be very hard. I think quite a few of them are really discouraged from working or doing anything outside of the home by their husbands, which is hard for a lot of women who are used to a more independent lifestyle. So it's not an easy life, and I think many, many of the marriages do not last, which is understandable. I don't know any other culture it would be harder to marry into than the Saudi culture, but maybe I'm wrong. The gal in this book, At the Drop of the Veil, talked about how hard it was to live completely within the women's realm. Her mother-in-law and all her sisters-in-law were her life, her companions from day to day, all day long, and everything was same routine. There was never getting out of the house, virtually never. If you did get out of the house, it was to go to somebody else's home and visit there. And so she talked about how stifling that was. However, her husband worked with the king at the time. Well, he was Prince Faisal, who later became King Faisal. And so he was called to do a lot of traveling and business, and she was always taken along. So she had some outlet, which other people wouldn't have.
Well, when would they see their husband then?
Well, rarely. At night, sometimes, if he's around. And that was another thing she was so frustrated about. She said, he isn't even here for me to yell at, to tell him how frustrating this is. I can't even talk to him about it. But the men generally associate with the men, and that's their entertainment. You know, the wife and the child are left at home, and he goes off. And we have an Algerian couple that lives upstairs from us with a young baby, and we hear this going on, and it really hurts me. We'll hear all these men having a gay old time out in the living room, and then the TV going in the bedroom, which is obviously where she's sitting all by herself, and having to stay away from the men.
Who does the shopping?
The men do most of the shopping, at least the food shopping, because of course they have the transportation, and so they're pretty much in charge of that. I think that the women probably do most of the clothes shopping, like for the children. There's a women's shopping area in town, which is always kind of fun to go to. They have a lot of children's clothes and material shops, and the women are always in that area. So I think they probably do most of that. But the men generally do all the grocery shopping. It's not very often in the grocery stores that you see Saudi women sometimes you'll see the men and women together, but usually...
You said yesterday that they had women's university and men's university, and they're definitely separate and taught by women.
Mm-hmm.
What are these women going to the university for?
Various things. Many of them, I think, just go because they're bored and have nothing else to do. The one Saudi lady I know of on campus wanted to go to study the Quran. She wanted to study Islam, and she was not allowed to, which I think is a real discrepancy. So she went to study English, which seems so odd that they wouldn't even let her study their own religious works. But she just wanted to do something. She doesn't have really any ambitions what to do with her degree if she ever gets it. So she studies English.
Are any of the women allowed not to be married? And they're not their fathers may go?
No. Allowed not to be married? I think that...
Because you said that they, in that one instance, that they, you know, picked a husband for the daughter.
Mm-hmm. Generally, a husband is chosen for the daughter. But nowadays, in most cases, the female is allowed to reject that arrangement if she wants to. Not in all cases, but in some.
Does she have a way of livelihood if she doesn't get married?
Well, that's just it. There's nothing else she can really do except live at home. There's only...
Does she have to leave the country?
No. No. I don't think so. I've never
Saudi
known of anybody.
Men can come to our country to go to school.
That's right. Only the men can come to be educated here. So she would be stuck with her family. There's one gal I know of who's, I think, 23, who rejects the system, does not want to get married, does not want to be stuck home alone with a house full of kids while her husband's out having a good time. And so she keeps refusing to get married. But so what's all that's left for her is to stay at home. A good friend of mine tutored her in English. She's so hungry to get out and get any interaction she can. She gets tutoring in English. I think takes some courses. But other than teaching, that's about one opportunity for the women. They could teach.
Nursing?
Not nursing. Some of them go to become doctors. Nursing is thought of to be a very low job. Of course, you're dealing with people's bodies, with cleaning people, doing all these horrendous things. Mostly all nurses are from the Philippines and from Korea. They're shipped in to do the menial. I've never seen a Saudi nurse. There are some Saudi doctors, women doctors, also few and far between. I think quite a few of them study for medicine and then find there are no jobs for them when they finish.
Mm-hmm.